our modest draw near and give their attention to the poor disaster. God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 063180, United States of America versus Juan R. Hughes appellant, Ms. Sussman for appellant, Ms. Kelly.
Good morning, Your Honor. Let me start off by a general remark. The case law, as well as I recognize, that judges, trial judges, as well as trial lawyers are human, and the trial process is a very human process, and things occur during trials that are often regrettable, but not significant in terms of an appellate situation. This is a situation that we believe is very different. There is a limit to what a trial judge can do, and there are definite limits to what a trial lawyer can withstand.
Counsel, the way you frame that leads to my first question. Is it your argument that the trial counsel made mistakes here, or that it's just that the district court so restricted her ability that it prevented her from doing her job?
I think it's the latter, Your Honor. I think that
this is not a Strickland claim, then.
Well, it is. Any ineffectiveness claim is necessarily a Strickland claim.
No, that's not the case. Strickland makes clear that he's talking about incompetent counsel.
Well, I would submit that the question of and get to what exactly the trial counsel, the effect of the court's continuous, and I would think that's an apt characterization, continuous battering of her, and I'm not going to go into the details of it. That's in the brief. That's in the record. What we found and what we elicited at the 2255 hearing was that we had a trial counsel who ultimately performed in a way that compromised her client's interests. By her own admission, this was an attorney who was consistently questioned by the court about competence, understanding of the law, honesty.
So you're saying that she was incompetent?
I'm saying that as a per se matter.
You haven't argued that in your brief.
Well, I think I did. I said I think that when an attorney says that she refuses to make motions because she's afraid of the reaction of the judge, that the attorney has failed to perform as an attorney is required to perform. I don't think the Sixth Amendment
happens all the time. I mean, attorneys have to gauge their strategy for what's going on in the courtroom, and people do that all the time. I can tell you some motions I didn't make because of concern about a judge and how a judge would react to them.
Well, if someone said that, if a trial lawyer said that I was concerned about too many objections, how it might look in front of the jury, that I would look like I was trying to block testimony, I think those are legitimate trial tactics. A trial judge is not a parental figure that you're there to please.
No, I understand.
When that becomes the case,
my point is that you're making a claim not about the counsel's incompetence. That's Strickland. It seems to me you're making a claim about the judge's conduct. You're saying the judge created an atmosphere that prevented a fair trial from going forward.
Well, clearly there's an interconnection. I'm sorry.
And if that's I think that is the case, you convince me otherwise, then you've got problems under Massar.
Well, I find Your Honor's question somewhat surprising because, as I envision this argument, that the Sixth Amendment requires that a criminal defendant be furnished with an attorney that meets certain standards. In this particular case, the lawyer, by her own admission, has indicated that she was so affected, intimidated by the trial judge's demeanor and his attitude toward her. And I'm not going to get into a line-by-line analysis of what the court did. That's spelled out pretty succinctly in the brief. That in essence, that she became less than what the Sixth Amendment requires. And when you have an attorney who is not functioning at the level of what the Constitution requires, you've been denied your effective right to counsel, and the trial process has been turned into something to which you cannot have the requisite confidence in the result and in the process itself. There's an interconnectedness between what the court does and the effect of counsel, and I'm saying that equation, when added up, renders counsel ineffective. If your lawyer says that she was unable to speak for a day or more because of fear of the trial court or because of her emotional disturbance, I always thought the right to remain silent is for the defendant, not for the lawyer. You have a lawyer who is not speaking on your behalf during potentially critical phases in the trial. When you have a lawyer who's afraid to make objections for fear of the rancor of the trial judge, you have a lawyer who's not making the record for you. When you have a lawyer who will not cross-examine for fear of the court's reaction to her and feels that it's necessary to give questions to co-counsel and suggest that they ask those questions, you do not have the independent lawyer that the Constitution requires. I don't need to tell anyone that in a multi-defendant trial, most of your problems are on your own side of the table.
Well, Mr. Sussman, assuming that you are making two claims here.
That's correct.
One about judicial bias and another about ineffective assistance of counsel. Are you in a different posture with regard to the judicial bias claim than you are the ineffective?
The court's obviously referring to the government's procedural default argument. Somewhat, but I don't think that it's fatal to my judicial bias argument, and this is the reason why. The procedural default doesn't apply, as I understand it, to situations where there are unique circumstances. In this court, we're somewhat, this circuit is somewhat unusual in the sense that an ineffectiveness claim can be asserted on direct appeal. Other circuits require that it be asserted as a collateral matter. I don't think there's any case law in the circuit that says that it must be asserted on direct appeal. And the uniqueness of having trial counsel function as appellate counsel, which was the case in this matter, I would, as the court knows, I was not either of those, performed either of those functions. It's well known that you don't expect trial counsel to shoot themselves, herself, himself in the foot, and that normally there is no procedural default as to that claim.
Okay, well, that let's assume you can argue that for the IAC claim, but what about the judicial bias claim?
Well, I think that, as I said, that this is unique because there's an interconnectedness. I don't see how you could really make the judicial bias claim in this case that without getting into the claim of ineffectiveness. In terms of a lawyer who would argue the prejudice, the lawyer would be fighting with one hand behind her back if she argued judicial bias and its effect and prejudice without and holding back the fact that that prejudice not only impacted the jury and poisoned the atmosphere of the trial, but actually had that intense emotional effect on her. So I think that in essence, this is a unique situation where those two things coalesce. You just can't, in good faith, make one argument without making the other. And I would believe that connectedness requires that the court consider both claims. I'm not unwilling to admit that I certainly consider the ineffectiveness claim to be the stronger of the claims. The history of judicial bias claims in terms of their effect on trial is well known and fairly detailed in this circuit, and that by itself probably wouldn't get Mr. Hughes very much. But when that...
But as I understand it, you can't win ineffective assistance unless you win judicial bias.
Well, I don't think, if I understand the court...
The way you're constructing your case...
I don't.
The essential predicate for ineffective assistance of counsel in this case is judicial bias.
Well, that's quite correct. But I think what Judge Brown was asking was the question whether, if you segregated those two claims, you necessarily have to prevail on one to prevail on the other. I think that it's very easy, or that this court could say that the conduct by itself did not amount to by itself without any consideration of the effect it had on counsel was not enough to overthrow the result, but that in turn, when we see its effect on trial counsel, which I think is dramatic and pretty well...
She raised no objection? That would be an astonishing precedent. I can't win judicial bias. It isn't enough.
Well, but it's...
But counsel now complains after the fact, never having raised this as an objection before the trial, that I was under emotional stress and so I didn't serve my client well. That's essentially what you're now arguing. We couldn't write a precedent like that. She didn't even claim judicial bias.
In her initial brief?
She didn't claim it anywhere. She didn't say, she could say to the trial judge, let's get out of the jury's earshot. I want to preserve a claim.
Well, she did say to the judge and approached the judge on some occasions trying to ameliorate the situation, which I think...
The judge, well, you know, the problem for you is the judge tried to ameliorate it, too. He was a tough guy. There's no question about it. But on several... He's also a smart guy. And on several occasions, he said, I want to make sure the jury understands. I also want to say to counsel, he's attacking counsel. I'm not attacking the defendant and all of that. I mean, you know, so there was jousting going on. It was rough. But counsel never objected.
Well, there are two... Well, there were mistrial requests during the course of the trial. She approached the bench about what the court was doing. I think that the record was preserved that she was unhappy. If you're saying that she didn't specifically say we should adjourn these proceedings or mistry this case because of the way you're treating me,
yeah.
I don't recall that actually being said in the record.
You would know how to do that, right?
If that situation arose, yes, I would know how to do that.
Emotional stress that you're now claiming that she felt.
Objection
to make.
If I had human traits, I probably would be in that situation. But fortunately, that's never been the case.
Well, right, and I suspect, knowing you, if you were, you would say, "Can I'd like to be out of the jury's earshot, and I want to voice an objection and put it on the record."
Well, as you said, the judge is a tough guy, smart guy, and experienced guy. There are other ways to handle this matter. Counsel could have been replaced. The second chair brought in.
The problem is, if you do it the way you're now asking, and I totally understand what you're saying, we run the risk of writing a precedent that would encourage sandbagging.
Sandbagging in what respect, sir?
Counsel comes up after the fact and said, you know, I mean, I really was under stress, having preserved nothing.
Well, if counsel...
And then we become psychologists in figuring out whether a person was really under terrible stress. You make your objections. That's what we expect good trial counsel to do, is you protect yourselves by making your record.
Well, I think, with all due respect, I think Your Honor's argument is somewhat...
Especially when I'm starting with the premise, your concession, that you can't really win on judicial bias.
I wasn't conceding. I was conceding that one argument is better than the other, and the judicial bias claim is an uphill claim.
And if you lose judicial bias, you still think you can win on ineffective assistance, and I can't imagine how.
Well, I think that it's entirely appropriate for a court to say that the judge's actions, in terms of its effect on trial counsel, compromise this process.
Even though there's no judicial bias.
I mean, what you're saying is a per se finding of judicial bias as...
Say, I just, under the legal standard, there's no judicial bias.
There's judicial conduct. I mean, maybe we're parsing words here. I'm saying that the conduct of the trial court, had it no effect on the lawyer, would be a different situation.
How do we measure the effect on the lawyer?
Well, we have the lawyer's own words in terms of, and that's what we...
The sandbagging problem.
Well, I think the sandbagging...
It can't be the... We're talking about... I'm thinking about, what do I write? What does this court write? And you, at some point in an opinion, we'd have to say, and so the way we measure the impact on the lawyer is what? It can't be that we just say, well, we'll ask the lawyer, how did you feel? And if the lawyer said, I really felt badly, that wins it.
Well, I don't think that's what the lawyer said. I think that there was supporting testimony from another lawyer that trial counsel approached him, asked other people to make motions, asked other people to ask particular questions in cross-examination. So this, most criminal defense lawyers, we consider ourselves a hardy breed. Bleeding in public is not one of the things that we do best. I think that the literature in this area indicates that counsel tend to understate the effect of this kind of pressure on them than overstate it, just as counsel tend to generally cast themselves in the best light in these collateral attacks. The notion that someone is willing to fall on their sword for their client is probably not unknown, but somewhat unusual. And I think the court is taking the unusual view about trial counsel's statements that she was sandbagging with the hope.
No. I'm saying, listening to your argument, if we were to buy what you were saying, so then it has to be written. And I don't know how you write it, given what you're saying, without setting up situations where sandbagging is pretty easy for counsel. I'm not suggesting that this particular counsel meant to sandbag. But
well,
I am listening to your argument and thinking about how would this be written without us setting up a situation in an opinion where counsel would be able to sandbag. I can't show judicial bias, Your Honors, but I really was unhappy during trial.
No. What we can show is, and what counsel's actions obviously, well, counsel could not dictate what the court said and what the court did. That was what the court said and did. And that's clear, and it's on the record. And I would submit that the court should have no problem saying that this is over the line. And I'm not going to go into the line-by-line kind of thing, but this was equivalent, to analogize it, it was as if a prize fighter had been body punched for 10 rounds. The effect's cumulative, it's debilitating, and it's dispiriting. And that's exactly what counsel described at the 2255 hearing. And I don't think the court should have any problem crediting that kind of testimony. It was a pretty bad beating to take for a period of time, especially when other lawyers are being trumpeted, the U.S. attorney is being hailed, and the prosecutors are being hailed. It's a pretty bad beating, and the court's notion about the curing instruction, it's the afterthought. After you've gone too far, you cure it with I didn't mean any lawyer in particular. It's kind of like when your client's locked up. Everybody knows your client's locked up. It's this myth we engage in that the jury really doesn't know, that those four large guys sitting behind your client aren't just there as spectators.
We understand your argument, Mr. Sussman. You're over your time limit.
I apologize. I did save
for a rebuttal.
Thank you, sir. Ma'am.
We know that you were appointed by the court, and we appreciate your assistance.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, John Manarino for the United States. Appellant even today has failed to explain what the district court in denying his 2255 did wrong in finding that there was no cause or prejudice to excuse his procedural default. Instead, at that hearing, Ms. Lepley took the stand, and we don't have to speculate about what was in her mind. She said, "I chose not to raise a judicial bias claim on direct appeal, and I can tell you why." And she then went ahead and did that. She said, "I thought there were more promising issues at stake here. I thought I had a better chance of prevailing if I weeded out this issue."
You would agree that an ineffective assistance of counsel claim is not procedurally barred, right? Massaro says you can bring that in your 2255, right?
Well, the problem is, as the court has pointed out, is that it's predicated upon the judicial bias claim, which he failed to raise. He's attributing the judicial bias as the cause for the ineffectiveness. He's saying that the effect of that bias exhibited by the trial judge was to render his counsel ineffective.
Well, he's hedging himself. He's saying she took a bad beating. Maybe it wasn't judicial bias, but it was a bad beating.
Well, but he's attributing it to the trial court's conduct, right, whatever label we attach to it. But he's saying because of that, she was deficient and it was to his prejudice. He hasn't shown either of those. And when she was asked what was the effect of the trial court's demeanor toward her, both she and Mr. Brightley, who testified at the hearing, said, well, she was not simply rolling over and giving in to what the judge wanted to the detriment of her client, that instead she felt an obligation to put on the record what she was observing, to make a record of that, and she felt she had no choice but to do so, even though she was aware that the trial court might be displeased with that.
The district court discussed the ineffective assistance claim with respect to the appeal. Did the district court, I couldn't find anywhere where it discussed the ineffective assistance claim with respect to the conduct of the trial.
Well, the district court was looking at it in a cause and prejudice sense, that the defendant had not raised any claim pertaining to judicial bias, whether resulting in a due process violation on fair trial grounds or causing an ineffectiveness of his trial counsel. And the district court was saying, well, you haven't raised any of those things previously. You haven't raised anything pertaining to judicial bias. Therefore, you have to show cause and prejudice. And his assertion on the cause and prejudice argument was, my appellate counsel was ineffective. And so the trial court, the Judge Robertson, was looking at, was your appellate counsel ineffective in failing to raise that? And that's when the testimony came through with Ms. Lepley about, well, why didn't you raise this? What was the effect of it? How likely did you think you were to prevail on raising a claim predicated in whatever manner on a judicial bias claim? And so at the end of its order, in the 2006 order, the trial Judge Robertson said, I'm finding that there was not that kind of excessive, harsh treatment that would have excused the failure to raise it, that it should have been raised, it wasn't, and he hasn't shown cause for that failure. So he didn't rule on the merits, he ruled on the procedural grounds, and he made it clear.
Can't you have a situation where the trial judge's conduct is so outrageous but really not biased against any particular party. It just renders trial counsel on either side very limited. Just doesn't like the person, and it's just on them constantly.
Well, that is a possibility, but the focus, again, is not so much on, as the I think in Edmund the court pointed out, it's not on whether the court's conduct left something to be desired or things were should have been better left unsaid. The focus is on what was the effect of that. And on that question, when Lepley testified and they asked her, well, what was the effect of the trial court's treatment of you? She said, well, it certainly made me uncomfortable. It certainly factored into my decision-making. But when she was pressed for specifics, I mean, she said in very general terms on direct, well, there were motions I didn't make and questions I didn't ask. But when she was pressed for specifics, the only thing she pointed to were two things. First was the limitation on her cross-examination of Duquette Barr, who was a government witness tying appellant to the murders, of which he wasn't convicted. Right. And even there, that was an issue which, as she conceded, she did raise that issue on direct appeal. She lost, but she raised and fully litigated that issue on direct appeal, and there was no error found. Second, she said, well, I advised my client not to testify. He expressed an interest in testifying. I told him I didn't think it was a good idea. And one of the things that factored into that was how things might go given the trial court's demeanor. But she made clear it was not the only factor, that in fact, she didn't think she had a defense at all for the drug counts, the distribution and the quid count. She said that as to the other count, she'd never put a defendant on the stand in a conspiracy case, and it was a very dicey proposition. So she was, that was not her inclination in any event. It was something she considered. But it was not as if she never said, well, I would have put him on, but for the way the judge was treating me. And even further, there was no proffer whatsoever that appellant would have testified if she'd told him to do so, that he had anything useful to say, much less that it would have made any difference in the outcome. That instead, she explained there were many reasons that factored into that. Certainly this was one of them, but not to the point where she said, well, that made the difference to me, or that was a principal factor or a substantial factor to me. It was one of many things, and as a strategy matter, she chose not to do that. Just as tactically, she chose not to raise the bias claim on appeal.
Now, are you pinning it on the deficiency side or the prejudice side on ineffective assistance and the arguments that you've just made?
Well, we think it's both. We don't think he's able to show either one. First of all, on deficiency, she's entitled to make reasonable tactical decisions about how to advise her client. And as she explained, there were many factors arguing against putting him on the stand and testifying. It was something she'd never done before. She generally viewed it as a hazardous proposition at best. And she didn't have much of a defense in this case anyway to the counts he was convicted of. On the prejudice side, again, there was no proffer at all, that much less a showing, that he would have testified, he would have had something useful to say, or that it would have made any difference in the outcome of the case. And given her concession that, well, I didn't have a whole lot of a defense on the drug counts anyway, it's very unlikely that it would have had that effect.
Well, that may show that she was not, in fact, ineffective. But are you conceding that he could bring the claim?
No, because again, it's predicated on the judicial bias claim. He's not saying, well, you know, she simply made mistakes. She's saying the court's treatment of her rendered her ineffective. The way she was badgered by the trial court on a repetitive basis, according to his characterization, rendered her ineffective. It had the effect. He's trying to show what was the prejudicial impact of this
but that's
bias.
That's not necessarily judicial bias.
No, again, I don't mean to right, the manner in which she was treated, whether rising to the level of bias or not.
Do you think that's a Strickland claim?
We think he does still have to show deficiency and prejudice under Strickland.
It's a Strickland claim to make the argument that the lawyer was not incompetent, but that the judge so restricted the lawyer's ability to put on the case that it rendered her assistance ineffective.
Well, we
is that a strict? Is that
we don't think they can be separate. We think it is, Strickland is inherent in that argument. We don't think you can pull it aside because he still has to make that showing. Whatever the causation is, whatever the explanation for why it turned out that way, he still has to make that showing of deficiency and prejudice. The fact that he's predicated it upon the trial court's treatment of her means that his failure to raise that issue initially precludes him from making that showing. And if he can't make that showing, then he can't get to step B, which is what was the outcome of that treatment, what was the result of that, what was the prejudice, and you know, the prejudice being, well, my counsel made mistakes that prejudiced me. So he can't get to that analysis, to that Strickland piece of it, until he makes the showing that, in fact, the trial court's treatment of her was extreme enough or rose to such a level that it impaired her performance in that way. And we think because he hasn't raised that on direct appeal, he's barred from raising even the ineffectiveness claim because it's predicated upon that bias argument.
You keep characterizing it as a bias.
There's
no procedural bar.
Right. I'm just using it. Well, I'm using that shorthand, but the argument that the trial court's treatment of her, whatever we call it, the argument that the trial court's treatment impacted the trial in some way was never raised on direct appeal, whether we want to call it bias or simply say there was a random comment that had some prejudicial effect. That claim was never raised, and she made a conscious decision not to do that. And she explained, I thought it was going to overshadow.
Bias claim, but you've already said there can be conduct by a trial judge that is not biased, but that would be so offensive, it could cause an attorney to be deficient. So you wouldn't have to raise that on direct appeal. You could raise it collaterally.
Well, we think
you're arguing they just haven't done it here.
Well, what we're arguing is that if he's attributing any prejudice to the behavior of the trial court,
if they're arguing bias, you're right, it wasn't raised. But if they're arguing something other than bias, then it's a different case. You acknowledge you're just saying they lose it here.
Well, they lose it whatever point that the court wants to look at it. But we think that when it's predicated upon the way in which the trial court behaved, and no challenge was made to that on appeal, despite the fact that it was on the table in the trial court, and she did complain about the trial court's treatment of her at trial, that she made a conscious decision to completely put that aside and instead focus on what she thought were more promising issues, the fact that that tactical decision was made precludes him from bringing it up now. If there were no other questions, we'd ask for an affirmance. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sussman, you can have a minute for rebuttal time.
I'll just need a minute or two. First of all, I just want to clarify. I think Judge Edwards hit the nail. Judicial bias, we're not using it as a term of art. It's what the judge did, for lack of a more specific term. The court also should recall that the hearing in this matter was, because of a variety of reasons, 8 years after the trial. It's almost impossible for an attorney to recall line and verse what their thinking was 8 years. So to some extent, and nothing seems as bad 8 years later than it did at the time. But I think most importantly, in terms of the prejudice argument, they talked about two distribution counts. Obviously, the count that we're concerned with here was a conspiracy count for which Mr. Hughes was sentenced to life imprisonment. That was later changed to 30-year sentence. But it was not Ms. Lepley's strategy to concede two small distribution counts that would get the client life imprisonment. Those were far lesser counts that would have probably earned him a far lower sentence. Her decision-making was skewed in some part. It's impossible to quantify it. Because of the fear of what the trial judge would do based on past performance, if she put her client on the stand with regard to her questioning and her client's responses. Seems to me that that's a denial that requires this court to take notice. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.